This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We have four women poets today, and they are each very different in their poetry. However, they are also teachers, editors, presenters of other poets. And our first is Rose Solari, and she's going to say hello with an opening poem.
Letter to my father. Still beautiful, and still the first best place I could ever call home. Your eyes at the end were not opaque, but simply elsewhere. It took me a while to realize this wasn't personal, that trying to call you back with anecdotes or books wasn't wrong, but silly. Like me as a child trying to flag down planes that passed over our backyard by waving my hands. You were more than ready. You'd been preparing yourself for years, so that when whatever it was you saw in those last days walked into the room, your body would shed its names like water to fit its indifferent arms. Now my body feels as empty as yours must be. Organs removed, blood extracted, and the breath that carried your soul in words to me now vanished in air. Outside, birds sing their usual songs, water slides or trips or runs. Inexplicably, the world without you goes on. I could carry you everywhere, like a stone in my shoe, and still never see your face on this earth again.
The voice of Rose Solari. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. Rose is a writer whose work intersects classical myth and everyday life. And she has a book coming out which signifies all of that. It is called Orpheus in the Park, and she is also the author of Difficult Weather. Rose, do you agree that you can express your humanity best through mythology?
Well, I think now, yes, I do feel that way. My first book has no myth in it at all. It's all very personal, very autobiographical. And it was only after both of my parents passed away, very close together, that I started to look at mythology, sort of as a way to figure out how to deal with being orphaned quite suddenly. And reading those old stories, I think, taught me quite a lot about the people around me, what was going on in my everyday life. I think it's why they lasted so long.
Let's hear another.
Great. This one is about Achilles, who I think everybody knows about, the great warrior of the Trojan War. And this poem is imagined to take place in the time immediately preceding that war, so before Homer. Achilles on shore. Tougher than hands that have carried heavy ropes all day in the summer sun is the heart that feeds on itself, incapable of solace in the outer air. Harder than most will be the man who knows that in only one place is he weak, and who allows his lover to see that once and by accident. On deck he feels the serious world surround him, knows the water that rocks his dreams is the water that carries him out beyond the reach of her voice or her heavy heart. Inside the silence of other men, inside his armor, he is most free. Hear what the world will say of him later, his muscles carved into marble, his words on the city's walls. Hear how the women will dream of making him soften like butter for baking. She could have told them a few real stories, spoken of the price she paid for igniting more than desire. She knows more than he does of this particular kind of war, of how the map we make can betray us, turn us another way. Tonight in his bed made of skins taken from other warriors, tonight in her silk, she sees their farewells written tight in the script of the gods. Mortal women cannot compete. The legends are full of those who tried and lost more than their lives. Turned into trees or stones or animals, they call out at night to each other, remembering love like fruit gone to rot in the damp island air. Tell me a story, she says, but he is near empty of words. However full his heart, he will never be able to loose its weight in language. He will hurt her tonight, she knows, and then say he is sorry. Tomorrow the boats pull out again. There is always another war, and when he returns, if he returns, he will be somebody else anyway. They say she should be grateful for whatever it is she has got. For him, loving and killing are part of a single song, the one he sings to himself to lull them both to sleep. He will blame her later for listening and for remembering. For now, he presses her head against his chest, feels the tears he does not cry slip down her face. She puts her ear to his heart and listens. How the beat of the world grinds through his weary blood.
The voice of Rose Solari. Rose has received many honors and awards, and she has received the Randall Jarrell Poetry Prize, the Academy of American Poets University Prize, and grants from the D.C. Commission on the Arts and also the Maryland State Arts Council. What I like best about your work, and when you use mythological characters, is it occurs to me that the corporal part of them is what gets them into trouble.
Yes, that is true.
mean, the good thing that you do as a poet is you talk about their souls, but you put it right smack in a body, and the body is always capable of seduction and all of the stuff.
And it has its own desires, and it has its own needs, and it carries you places that you may not want your body to carry you sometimes. But
So that's the brilliant part of what you're doing. You don't make airy-fairy people floating around. You really peg them into the soul in the body, and that is powerful.
And that's the wonderful thing about those old stories, I think. I mean, these characters are not translucent, you know. Aphrodite is wildly seductive. Achilles' rage and courage are huge, and they're very body-based things, you know,
that I think we can relate to. In Orpheus in the Park, I think you have caught all that and within one book. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
You're on the faculty of the Writer Center.
Have been for 15 years,
15. Yes. And also you have been teaching various places, I know. Sometimes in Annapolis at St. John's College. Where else?
I do some visiting writer work at St. John's. I've taught on and off at the University of Maryland in their undergraduate honors program. And I've done a lot of workshops at conferences for psychology associations, myth organizations. I've traveled around a lot doing workshops with people who aren't necessarily, for whom poetry isn't necessarily their first love, but is something they'd like to discover.
You have been working also with spiritual agencies and many, many forms.
Yeah.
Rose Solari, I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're going on.
All right. This is from the other strand of poems that's in the next book. It's not a myth. It's an elegy, as with the poem for my father that I began with. This is an elegy for a part of the self, and it's called Elegy for the Virgin. When at 7 I watched him rising shirtless from the blue corrugated circle of his parents' Sears Roebuck's pool, saw him run the bright towel imprinted with football players helmeted and leaping over his arms and legs, then shake his hair from side to side, the water spinning for him a halo of falling light, I ran to my older sister's room to tell her the ultimate thing had happened. I had fallen in love. The boy next door, no less. His mother grew roses red and pink and had given him her gray eyes. It leads here, I thought, years later, lying beneath that first lover, all the fumbling and fear it was for this. How soon did I realize that every time I touched someone, another possibility blinked out. And the radiance we found was not the kind that surges through the body playing kickball or jumping rope on summer nights, but more like the beam of a flashlight you carry into the cellar again when you can't sleep. You almost know what you're doing. You can almost see what you're trying to find. Sometimes I try to imagine my body back to its virginity. Did I know something in my untouched state, lost to me now so long I've forgotten its shape? Sometimes I wish I could live again for a week, for a month, in a world not cracked by feeling, not made dangerous by desire, where it was blessing enough and all I wanted on this earth to see Brian Fugel, 11 years old, in his chopped lowrider Levi's, standing in the apple-less Eden of his mother's rose tree garden, a bearer of mystery, but no despair.
That's Rose. You can check her out on www.rosesolari.com also. And once again, the psyche, we have the state of the psyche, but the human form is capable of seduction.
That does seem to be a running theme here, doesn't it?
It's a great combination. So let's go on. We're at the Library of Congress.
This is a lighter-hearted myth poem, and it's based on a photograph I saw of a man at a wine tasting looking very seriously down into his glass. Too seriously, I thought. Wine tasting. Dionysus would slap you silly if he could see you now, sniffing and twirling and sipping and, dear God, spitting it out. What mortal arrogance, the mess you've made of his gift. Now, let's start over. Throw back your head and drain this puny glass with one loud gulp. Then send, no roar, for a cup carved out of animal horn, deep enough that when you reach the bottom, you'll see two horns, two hands, two mouths. Then you'll be worthy to grab the woman on your left, who feels as you do now the rush of sweet blood to the brain and to the thighs, and put your grape-stained mouth to hers. We are all of us nothing more than empty vessels that the god can fill with his heart-made, heart-poured wine. Drink, you fool, and love. Become divine.
What do you think makes a successful poem?
A sense of discovery, a sense that between the first line and the last line, some territory's been crossed, some travel has happened. I think for me as a writer and also as a reader, I want to be surprised. I want to be taken somewhere I can't get on my own.
Good enough. And another poem.
This is for my mother. My mother's elephants. Because of their size and the shape of their ears and the sweetness and wisdom she claimed to see in their miraculously lashed eyes, my mother, for as long as I can remember, loved elephants. At the zoo, she would linger, chuckling before their house, the babies in particular seeming to hold some charm for her, their wrinkled legs belying their years. Someone in cruelty had called her an elephant once when she was a girl because of her size, which she could not control, despite a diet of not much more than cigarettes and overperked coffee. Perhaps her fondness for those creatures started then, a way of turning the pain around, as after her death I would tell my friends that it was easier to love my mother now that she'd lost the burden of her body. When she began to collect them, china, brass, and seashell, carved into the tops of wooden or pewter boxes blown out of glass, it was a relief to all of us, I think, to have something to give this woman who almost no gift could please. Now she had found one small true thing that could never fail her. Regardless of value, she adored them all, arrayed them across the piano, her dresser, the windowsills, as if like guard dogs they marked the perimeters of her turf. She hardly went out at all by then. The cough that embarrassed her children, rising as it would at all the worst moments, kept her at home. And then the oxygen, of course, those last years of hers attached to a metal tank. Long after the dusting and polishing had become an impossible chore, we still brought them to her like flowers, like a language without anger we had found at last to speak. The weekend after my mother's funeral, I drove to the beach, thinking I might uncover, at the meeting of sand and water, better words than the priest who mispronounced her name had used to say goodbye. It was May and raining. Though each morning of those 3 days I put on my bathing suit and wore it beneath my clothes as if desire alone could change the weather. On the last night, with no answers yet to whisper into the emptiness you feel when your best enemy has fallen to infinite silence, I went for one more walk on shore and threw into the waves the last present I'd given my mother, a small silver elephant, its trunk raised up like a greeting, like a promise of something better, not only rest and peace, but please, I prayed, some happiness for that woman whose heart, so bruised by time and sorrow, might yet, in another life, be healed by joy.
The voice of Rose Solari. ¶¶ is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our poet now is Hilary Tom, and she grew up in Malaysia. She is with us now with an opening poem.
Why I love Florence. Water is not my element. Lake grass conjures tentacles and monster mouths. Fire is not my element, though I love to watch it dance, scarves of flame singing arias in a language I do not know. Air is not my element, though flying does not bother me. Like stone, I do not fear falling back to earth. Earth is my element. Somewhen I must have been stone, child of earth's ribs, stone pushing up a mountain, stone holding up a home, cobblestone laughing, tickled by sandaled feet. Once I was stone arm falling from a statue down to the safe, soft bottom of a brown river, the wind scrubbing the lines of my name from the water's skin.
The voice of Hilary Tom. I'm Grace Cavalieri. She is the author of 9 books of poetry and a book of memoirs. What is the title of that, your memoirs?
Lane with No Name.
I consider that the best book written in that year. It should have won the National Book Award. She's the editor-in-chief for WordWorks. That's our poetry press here in Washington, and poetry editor for the Potomac Review. And I want to say about your work that it is the source, the details are the source of so much emotional information. I think it comes from being a great prose writer, because you just need to know a lot of words, just details, and that is what enriches your poetry.
Well, thank you, Grace. I don't know. I've always found myself fascinated by the heft and taste and connotations of words, and that's why I took up writing.
It is the urgency for your work, and it is what lights up your work. Let's hear more.
6 months ago, I found I had lung cancer, and I'm going to read some poems that I wrote trying to come to terms with this diagnosis. Dark hour. Here it is, 4 a.m., and something woke you again. Perhaps the chill presentiment of the surgeon's knife, hairline thin as the guillotine's blade. You reflect that, yes, you have lived blithely and carelessly as Marie Antoinette, laughing, let them eat smoke, as you lit cigarettes over coffee, or under fear, or eating anger. All the times you needed a rush, a stall, a crutch, or a form of slow suicide. And no, if you had your life over, you would not change it. You cannot live in bland bubble wrap. Your life has been better than you imagined in teenage dreams, heaped up, brimming over with poetry, purpose, family, friends, money to travel and live well. Blessed with joy, love, and so much passion, you forgot to appreciate it sometimes. You look at your daughters, 3 strong women who came through the gateway of your body. Their childhoods seem long ago, and yet only yesterday. Time twists like a Mobius strip, curling in, stretching out of reach, and dimming as this dark hour of morning. You read cancer prognoses. What else to do, since your small lung cells in revolt have shredded your appointment book, scattered your tomorrows, and cut the planning section from the calendar? You regret you may not see your children's children, study their infant faces for likenesses to grandparents, touch their perfect fingers and palms, trace lifelines unrolling for them. But you were brought up not to be greedy, so you look at what you've had. You always knew you've been lucky, did not make the mistake of thinking you deserved any of it, and you say, Dayenu, thank you, maker of worlds. This will have been enough.
Hilary Tom, who rewards us always with understanding about our humanity, deeply satisfying words, always. Here she is again.
I find that the mind can be rational and calm and philosophical about impending death, but the body, the inner child, has its own very physical reactions, very undignified ones. This morning I woke crying, some core irrational and vain in me, cringing from the dream image of self, bald after chemo and too weak to climb the stairs. I will come and help you, my sister said, move to the downstairs bedroom. Choi, baby sister, I held on one hip with my right hand as I paced the house reading a book in the left, book that grandmother hid every time I put it down to change a diaper or warm a bottle. It irked her that I should enjoy a book while babysitting. Grandmother, who feared death but not ghosts, who insisted she was dying any time she heard a friend had died, until we took her to the doctor for a vitamin B12 injection. Suen, my other sister, calls from England. Older brother calls from Malaysia. Younger brother calls from Hong Kong. He will send a tape of Qigong, healing exercise, to push out bad qi and pull in good qi. We Chinese don't talk about feelings much. It is taken for granted, assumed that one knows love is there, a form of energy current of the natural world, a qi, one more active, that operates alongside all of the others to wake to. Because there is qi, even from the floor we walk on, the green exhalation of trees, or what emanates from movement of water, wind, the still silences of stone and bedrock.
Hilary Tom, her short story collection has just won the Washington Writers Publishing House Award, so it will be published right now, 2005, and we look forward to that. Let's hear more.
My husband Joe was devastated after the diagnosis of cancer, of course. After the diagnosis, for Joe, at breakfast you drink your coffee as if it were medicinal tea, chew your favorite cereal mechanically, gaze at me with the mournful eyes of a spaniel whose best friend's suitcases are packed and waiting by the door. I say, cheer up, Joe, it's not so bad. And you sigh and laugh. I'm sorry, here I am acting so down when you're the one suffering from cancer. Me, I'm just suffering from love. So Joe and I talked about death and what comes after. After the diagnosis, too, for Joe. You ask how I feel about life after death. Do I believe in the afterlife? I think not, I say, since what we believe is a matchstick tower of hopes and needs, not fact. Any words we use to raise our hopes are limited by our mud-bound minds. I believe, you say firmly, holding me with your eyes. I know I will be talking to you a lot when you are gone. I believe you will still be near to hear me, that love will keep us together. I think of Moses, who asked for God's name, and God said, Eye asher eye, I am who I am, or I am as I will to be. And with these words, I'm dreaming of cosmic light, how, maybe, souls are like atoms, indestructible, that will return to the source of light, that God, who would not waste even a mosquito, would not discard us and our memories, our loving. All I say to you, though, is hold me. Our arms still work. See me, love me, while our memories are with us and we with our bodies.
Our arms still work. Hilary Tom. And we'll have a closing poem. But I do want to ask you a question. I know your work very well. I have followed your work for 20 years. And I think that we know that it's animated with much richness. I wondered if you were happy or if you could tell us what you wanted from your poetry.
I've been very happy in my life and with being able to write poetry and to love poetry. I see poetry as a conversation, an ongoing conversation between dead poets and future poets. And we are sort of recording or carrying on this continuity, which is the same way as having children and grandchildren, I think.
I love it.
And this is in thanks for all the family and friends who have been so helpful to me. Cancer and other situations. Empty ocean. You treading water, swallowing, choking, spitting bitter salt, waves slapping your face hard. We each have our own private sea of troubles, and we suffer. We suffer sensations of drowning until friends, family, reach out with their stories, words, prayers, caring voices. So many life belts, planks, rubber tubes for us to grab onto, keep us, like hope, afloat.
The courage and the work of Hillary Thom. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We have four women poets here, and Karen Lalonde Alanier is among us. Let's hear your voice.
Gertrude Stein speaks to Paul Bowles, how his fiction began. Gertrude was old, old and round, more like vowel than consonant. She liked to disagree. Liked to declare. She dared to tell Picasso, "Get out of here." Bowles was thin as a conjurer's stick, thin, young, quick, but politic. "Paul," she said, "promise me no poetry." So he closed his eyes. Then more kindly she continued, "Try Marrakesh, Meknes, Fez, much to see and realize. It never ends. It never ends."
Karen Alanier is the author of five collections of poetry, and she is just reading from Looking for Divine Transportation. That was winner of the 2002 Towson University Prize for Literature, and she has been published variously throughout the country. Karen's work is passionate communication, and she draws it from experience, from the experience of history. We have characters, and these characters are going to wind up on stage because the opera is being readied. We'll talk about that. Let's hear another poem.
Raconteurs in Tangier, with an epigraph from Paul Bowles. What can go wrong is always more interesting than what goes right. Tell me those stories about you as shadow of Jane Bowles, breathing on her neck, shining light into her mouth, the pain she suffered. Waves of pain from a bad tooth, too much sugar in her mint tea. Ha! Like me, you suspected the majun, sticky with raisins, dates, honey, ground ginger, walnuts, nutmeg, anise, globs of goat butter, and of course cannabis cleaned of stems and seeds. You profited as her dentist in Tangier. No, you played would-be biographer, trying to extract details about her wedding, her marriage to me, Paul Bowles. Persistent, you declared yourself devotee, lived with her, wore her clothes, but never noticed she called her husband Bupple or Fluffy. Look at me, that man answering his door in necktie and jacket, that man who named her his muse. But she limped, didn't she? She lived on a floor below. You probably wonder if I chose a Jew to embarrass my father. You ate with us the night I ranted about my family. Do you think Jane served as my cover, that my mother expected grandchildren? The simple truth is I loved her as I loved no other. Tell me, was it true her female lovers like you poisoned her?
That's Karen Alanier. I'm Grace Cavalieri. And if you notice that she has characters in her poems, you will realize that she is a librettist who is going to have a premiere of an opera called Gertrude Stein invents a jump early on. This is with composer William Banfield. And you're getting just a little hint and a taste now of some of the characters. This is Karen Allenier.
The parrot that spoke to Jane Bowles. Baduppel, baduppel ma rap, the parrot said to Jane. Not, hi, where is your money? Not, hello, take me home. After the sunrise horseback ride, clip-clop, with 15 cowboys through the Costa Rican jungle, trees laden with howler monkeys, the big black male roaring, swinging from his tail, tiny babies clinging to their mother's tits, Jane and Paul were offered one of seven young parrots. Nonsense, Jane squawked. I don't break up families. But Baduppel perched alone on a man's fingers, so they bagged him in a burlap sugar sack along with their 27 trunks and Paul's typewriter. Jane heard him say, "Don't pinch me!" But Paul retorted, "He'll never learn English." The parrot ate their peppermint toothpaste, one Russian novel, and Jane's tortoiseshell lorgnette, much to her delight. That gift from her mother, she never liked it anyhow.
It is very beautiful to tell the direct story. And so you have stories you're telling us, and these are actual historical facts.
Yes. And the story of Jane and Paul Bowles might be a new libretto. And you know, of course, that Gertrude Stein knew Paul Bowles and that she called him Freddie, actually.
Karen's a librettist. She is going to have a new opera, and the poems we are hearing now are premieres, and they will be the basis of perhaps yet another opera. Do you even know the title?
I would think Raconteurs in Tangier.
Okay.
Agonizer. Dear Bopple, I play and replay what I will say in this letter. Not sure what will actually be written, I cannot control my pen, and this is likely to be an agonizer. I tell myself not to mention that night in the Chelsea Hotel when you hit me. I said then, and I meant it, I forgive you. The trouble is, I must forgive you again and again for that moment frozen in memory. I know you needed to sleep so you could write music for Sir Ryan's Love's Old Sweet Song. Do you remember our honeymoon, the night in Guatemala City, when we met those students in a cafe, the ones reading Proust and Valerie? How I wanted to stay and talk to them. The beer was so bitter and you so bored. You said you were tired and fled to our hotel. These puppies made me giddy with talk and tequila carried from Mexico. They got the cat out of her bag. I grew so curious. Have you ever seen a brothel? One rakish guy asked. No, show me one. So the boys and I left the cafe for a house at the edge of town. As soon as we got there, a huge man dressed in uniform and packing a pistol in a holster on his hip pointed to me and said, "That one." Who was he? Why did he think I was a whore? I am the chief bodyguard of the dictator of Guatemala, he boasted. He came surrounded by his own bodyguards. Terrified, I thought I would wet myself in front of everyone, but the girls who worked there hustled me off to a back room and pushed me out a window. In the street, I hid for hours behind a mountain of stinking garbage. The bodyguards drove up and down the streets, shining a spotlight into every dark corner. I don't know how I got back to you alive, but I vowed I would never say what happened. The pen pulls its own tricks, as you know. Paul, why couldn't you be civil to Dick the shit in our New York City hotel room? He was just drunk, same as me. He was trying to have fun, same as me. What trouble could there be in reveling? And that woman in our tub, the one wearing my silk peignoir, a gift from my mother. So what? I would never tell Claire about her. That woman with unnaturally bright red hair. Claire would never know that drunken, passed-out woman wearing the silk gray gown wasn't me. Claire, I think I shall always call my mother by her name, Claire de Lune. How crazy she makes me still after all these years.
Karen Allenier, I'm Grace Cavalieri at the Library of Congress. And it occurs to me that you always create different strategies for your work. And that strategy happened to be the prose poem. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And some of the people in my workshops are struggling with this, trying to figure out why is she writing so much prose when she usually writes so compressed?
Well, it's a valid form of poetry. And would you claim it by any definition? Can you describe what a prose poem is?
Well, a prose poem, I guess, in my opinion, goes toward a storyline. And it still has elements of poetry in attention to the way the words sound and some images that occur. But there is more attention to the storyline.
Karen has been running WordWorks for some 30 years in Washington and producing many beautiful books that will last forever, presenting readings. She's a public servant as well as an inspired poet. And here is a final poem.
The Relevance of Mint. I breathe mint from his garden, preferring rose hips and lemon verbena. My lover grows peppermint and spearmint for my tea generously. Today I snip stalks and share the aromatic feast with Jonathan and Beverly, the new parents of Johnny, born 18 days into June. Anniversary of Etta's birth, the grandmother I lost during my first trip abroad. Much later, at a table detailed with red rose petals, I savored the ceremony of Moroccan mint tea, but I fell in love with mint when I carried my son Ivan. His name is John, too, but in Russian. I called my Russian grandfather honey because my mom's mom, Etta, summoned her husband Saul, no matter his mistresses, in that sweet way. The Lord is gracious, and so it is that Johnny, Jonathan, Ivan, Hank, Hans, Ian, Jack, Jean, Johan, Juan, Sean, Shane, Vanya, and Zane all mean John. The Lord is gracious. I breathe mint and mix honey into the tea I breathe from the leaves of my sweetheart grew in his garden. These fragrant leaves that sing, he loves me.
The source of your art, always people. And believe it or not, we have time for that last short poem.
Carbon. When I die, don't weave a shroud, don't dig a grave. Take my carbon and make me graphite. Don't press me to diamond and wear me on your finger or neck. When I die, I don't need to be blue gem, quarter carat or greater. I want to be a pencil given to an ardent poet who will hug me tight, for that I would burn.
Karen Lalonde Alanir, I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're at the Library of Congress, and we're celebrating four distinguished women poets who are editors, teachers, presenters, as well as authors. And Kim Roberts is here with us now.
Siamese twins. Chang and Eng shared a liver. For 8 years, they toured America and England performing acrobatics. Although denied entry to France, officials feared their malady would spread to pregnant women. In America, they always appeared with the image of an eagle and the motto, Union and Liberty, one and inseparable, now and forever. Like two states in a united nation. Like their home state, North Carolina, where they retired at 28, became farmers, married sisters, and between them sired 21 children. Emerson once wrote that life cannot be divided or doubled. Any invasion of its unity would be chaos. The soul is not twin-born, but the only begotten. I wonder how they taught themselves that delicate dance, when to fuse, when to be separate, how to make their own privacy. The newspapers wrote that Eng died of fright, waking next to his dead brother in the dark. But really, Chang died from a cerebral clot, and when blood pooled in his body, Eng bled to death. The body is a mysterious housing. It brings us pleasure, fails us daily, and closes a fragile sense of self. It is where we live. And when we die, our other half goes too.
Kim Roberts, I'm Grace Cavalieri. She's the author of a book of poems, The Wishbone Galaxy. And she's editor of an online journal, Beltway Poetry Quarterly. But that doesn't sound as important as it is. So just give us a one line, because this is a very powerful global journal you put online.
Well, global, I don't know. It's I feature poets who live in the greater Washington, D.C. area, which is kind of funny for the World Wide Web, but it's a sort of split personality journal. It is both a literary journal and also a resource bank for writers from the Mid-Atlantic region.
Just give us the www.
WashingtonArt.com.
That's good enough. And we'll go on now.
This next poem I want to read is about Walt Whitman, who has been an important influence. A couple of things you need to know about the poem before I read it. One thing is that Walt Whitman was a volunteer nurse during the Civil War and lived in Washington, D.C. for 10 years during and after the war. And his own health was compromised from doing that nursing. And he left here after 10 years to move to Camden, New Jersey, where he had relatives who could help care for him after he had a stroke that paralyzed one side of his body. And then the other thing you need to know is that he had a sort of obsession about the body. And before he even started his nursing, he was very interested in alternative healing theories. For example, he bathed every day at a time when most people did not because he was interested in hydropathy, the water cure. He was very interested in animal magnetism and phrenology. Do you know what phrenology is,
Grace? I do indeed. I'm looking at your forehead as we speak.
It's studying the bumps on the head. And the belief was that each bump on your head corresponded to a character trait. So this poem is called Fowler and Wells' Phrenological Cabinet. Walt Whitman made regular visits. He loved to touch the white porcelain head marked off in sections, appetite, grief, acquisitiveness, like a butcher's chart mapping the choicest meats. Whitman knew the body's limits and how the mind, a grid of memory and fear, narrows the range even further. He hated limits, prudence, high manners, but he loved a good system and wanted to learn this one's steady answers. Why wouldn't what's inside show up on the skin? The bumps of the head, small ones like hiccups, large ones that span three or four categories, elongated heads, ones that come to a point. His categories would need new names. Voluptuousness wears an open collar. Indolence takes the shape of a cardboard butterfly perched on his finger. Adhesiveness wants a walk on the dark docks, a ferry ride across the river. And sublimity roars like a leaf. His home in Camden, where I touched his rubber galoshes, once overflowed with stacks of paper, a chaos, a fire hazard. He wouldn't let the hired woman touch it. Whitman claimed an internal logic, even to disorder. He loved a good system. In the prison across the street from his house, men line the windows. Women on the sidewalk dance, arms above their heads, hold a pose like Cleopatra, then change. I thought at first, performance art? Then realized they were spelling with their bodies, forming O and L and P in the air. The body's news comes slowly. Whitman knew about longing. He nursed dying Civil War soldiers, knew the stink of rotting flesh, of pus staining a bandage yellow, the angel face we wear when we're asleep. He was large in sympathy. He knew something of fate and its strange journey through the gray thickets of infelicity and melancholia, the temperaments that form in the womb.
The voice of Kim Roberts. Here is a poet who tries to understand the world through science, actually. In fact, I've watched Kim through many revelations and generations, and now I find her to be a poet of the philosophy of science, and we will be hearing more about that. She has published in The American Poetry, The Last Generation, Hungry As We Are, The First Yes, Poems About Communicating. She's been published in Brazil, France, Canada, the United States, and Ireland. And here's Kim Roberts.
A lot of the poems that I've been reading and writing lately are concerned with the body, and especially extremes of the body. And part of that is because I nursed a friend who was dying of cancer in the last 2 years of her life. This is a poem about her. It's a hospital poem. It's about leaving her in the hospital and not being sure if she would still be alive when I came back the next morning. It's called Breath. In shallow intakes of air, you're sewn into a spiral of circulating current. Respiration, inspiration, flux and flow, the insubstantial air, unremarked, unremarkable, speckled and dust-pocked when caught by morning sun. My lungs to your lungs, curving convex like a bridge. The miraculous nothing after the anxious night. The hospital monitors marking what my own simple witness confirms. The air still coming and going, continuing. Its thin imagined tendrils, the breath from your rising chest, that leafless breath, bare and wintered, whose seldom black twigs remember a breeze when the world is doldrums and nothing stirs. No vacancy, no narrow absence, when your breathing takes wing against an empty sky.
At the Library of Congress, Kim Roberts writes to preserve the present even as it is leaving us. Another poem.
Hospitals used to have collections to teach doctors with. It's a little outdated now, but they would have skeletons and models and pieces of human bodies in jars. And there is one museum left that preserves that old way of teaching. It's called the Mutter Museum at the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. And this is based on two skeletons in their collection. It's called The American Giant and The Achondroplastic Dwarf. The American Giant has no name. For $50, his skeleton, no past, no history, was bought in Kentucky from a Dr. Foote in 1877. Only 22 or 24, we know that he was male, 7 feet, 6 inches tall. Inflammation or arthritis in his final years, researchers suggest, flattened his bones, kept him to his home, inactive, possibly in bed. Inside of his enfolding ribs, if you will please observe, the leftward spinal curve. If glass could melt, I'd climb in and drape his towering hips so high in the display around my shoulder blades. Although he is only the second tallest, a label claims he wins the prize for the longest known femurs of any skeleton in the world.
Hmm.
The American Giant keeps company with a woman puddling about his feet, someone's idea of a laugh, and a chondroplastic dwarf, Mary Ashbery, 3'6". To her Richmond, Virginia whorehouse, doctors were called in 1856. She was in labor, but in that narrow channel of her hips, the baby's head could not fit past. The doctors decided to smash the baby's skull, and there it is, too, evidence of the craniotomy on the floor of the glass case. It was not a success, and they only managed to remove the dead infant by cesarean hours too late. The mother lived 3 more days. These skeletons preserved for use still fascinate, still draw us into our medical studies, to marvel at our bodies. Mine isn't so bad after all. Better an imperfect shell, even these two would confess, than nothingness. And they remain here standing, gimcracks on a pedestal, immortal souvenirs, our kin, our forebears.
Beautiful momentum. I was just thinking how your language moves us. Each word moves us on with motion. That's Kim Roberts. We have heard what you've been working on. This will be obviously part of a book.
Hopefully, yes.
We have a title?
I'm not sure.
Well, what are you doing in terms of your own development as a poet? Because I have seen you go through many changes. Just by writing?
You know, it's mostly reading. Reading is the biggest influence on my work. Reading constantly, as many different voices as I possibly can, including, you know, many poets who write in very different styles than I do. It's, I think, crucial just to read ravenously.
Do you feel that you're going to stay with science?
You know, I've always been drawn to poetry of ideas, and poetry that engages the outside world much more so than poems of a sort of confessional mode. And I don't see that changing.
However, it is the vocabulary of the revelation that you give us with every work you do. Kim Roberts is her name, and she's going to read a final poem.
This poem was inspired by a strange sighting of fog that was perfectly captured inside one field, and the field had a fence around it, and the fog did not go beyond the fence. It's another cancer poem. This is called Medicine. Fog lay atop the single field like a bomb, perfectly contained, hovering just above the long grass. Perhaps descending from the sky, perhaps rising from the earth, in the field, fog connected the two, the ground and the air, sewed them together in loose white stitches. It looked medicinal, the fog healing the field. To your doctors who live by the body's obliquity, who make their living by your swerving, I raise these wisps of vapor. Indeterminate fog fixed and bounded by a slim rail fence, like the tenuous knots of a braided bandage, like a prayer, shapely in its shapelessness. It was nighttime, just, the sun gone and the last shreds of luster leaching from the trees, the pale pantheon gathering in a field before dispersing.
That's Kim Roberts. I am Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. You have heard the poetry of four Washington women: Kim Roberts, Rose Salari, Hillary Tom, and Karen Awanir. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production is by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. The series is brought to you by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C., and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. You can hear the series on www.loc.gov/poetry. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Additional funding was provided by the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art. Our engineer is Bill Haley. I'm Grace Cavalieri.